Good morning and welcome to WHTC Money Matters with your hosts, Kerry Cooley and Jack Godfrey from the Cooley Godfrey Investment Group of Zealand. The opinions voiced in this show are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult with your attorney, accountant, financial advisor, or tax advisor prior to investing. Securities are offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA, SIPC. And now, WHTC Money Matters.
Good morning, West Michigan. This is Jack Godfrey. Kerry Cooley is calling in today. Kerry, good morning.
Good morning, Jack. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. A little late this morning, but hey, we can deal with it.
Yeah, we can. No problem. Our listeners are still there. It's a beautiful day out, and I'm making my way up to Grand Haven here to watch a doubleheader baseball game that Christian's playing in.
All right. Hey, a lot to talk about. We're live today. We've been gone for a couple weeks, a vacation in between for both of us, and so two Saturdays we were gone. Did have great shows taped, but hey, today's show is going to be Guide to the Markets. We're going to recap what happened during the first quarter of this year. A lot of volatility, a lot to talk about. You know, Kerry, we can go right into some questions now. I guess we don't need to do by the numbers because by the time we do Guide to the Markets, that's a lot to go through. So,
I agree. That sounds good, Jack.
All right. So I will read the first question because it's the question is short. But the answer is...
I thought you were going to give me the long question again.
Well, yeah, probably. How much can I earn without losing widow's benefits? So let's just talk about... We're talking about Social Security. We're talking about a person who has passed away. And we're talking about how much can a widow earn and still get Social Security from her husband. So I'm going to read you the Social Security answer to this.
Okay.
If you are under full retirement age when you start getting payments, we deduct a dollar in benefits for each $2 you earn above the annual limit. For 2013, the limit is $15,120. The 2012 limit was $14,640. In the year you reach your full retirement age, we deduct a dollar in benefits for each $3 you receive in the annual limits until you reach your full retirement age. So for 2013, the limit is $40,800. In 2012, the limit was $38,880, or starting with the month you reach full retirement. So that's the answer.
Yeah, that's a mouthful. That's a lot to know, but that shows
so,
you.
So those are all interesting. Interesting. I'm getting some audio issues here, Chris. There we go. Nope. Still. I don't know if it's my headset.
Is it your headset?
Yeah, it could be.
I'll work on it.
Okay.
All right. So can you hear me, Jack?
Yeah, I can hear you now. Yeah, I'm just having some headset issues.
Okay. Well, you know, what you just said, that long answer, but it goes to show you how important it is to, in a situation like this for a widow, to consult and work with their tax professional, work with somebody at the Social Security office, and work with their financial planner through all this because, you know, there's strategies that can go into this, and, you know, if it makes sense, yeah, you can have a great job and you go over. If not, you know, it may make sense to keep certain things at a certain level. But again, you want to consult with those three people. Wouldn't you agree, Jack?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you know, if you're getting retirement benefits as a widow, now my mom took widow's benefits at age 60. She never had 40 quarters of payment because they live on a farm and all the Social Security went to my dad. So she was able to take the benefits at 60, widow's benefits, and it worked out good for her. But every person is unique here. So second question, this is not a question. It is a comment from a listener. You know, we get listeners who call us right in, and this is a listener who decided not to give us their name. So I'm going to read you this letter because we do respond for people who call us. On your pre-recorded program today, which was last week, or actually 2 weeks ago, April 5th, you talk a lot about passing wealth on to future generations. And we do, because we do have a lot of family meetings. Why not encourage your listeners to have a charitable trust so they can wealth can be transferred from without taxes for kingdom causes, especially if this money is taken from a 100% funded employer-sponsored IRA at the time of the owner's death? And this is from a regular listener. So no, that's a great comment. I mean, you know, when we have family meetings, one of the topics is a family value, and for family things is we talk about being philanthropic. And, you know, last year when it was still part of the law, it's not in part of 214, it was part of 12, 11, 12, and 13, where you could give your IRA as part of your RMD to charitable causes. And we still encourage people with a low-cost basis of a mutual fund, a low-cost basis of a stock, to give it away.
Well, yeah, and, you know, the other thing that we do so often in those family meetings is we go through each of the ways that people can gift. You know, you talked about gifting of an IRA in the past, and now it's no longer a law. But another thing that can be done is, like this listener has written in, is a charitable trust, where proceeds would go into a charitable trust, and the assets from that are gifted to charities based on what is written into the trust. And this can last a lifetime, but there's also a lot of other ways that people can gift charitable donations. One, I think locally, is like the Holland Zealand Foundation or a church. Let's say you gift money to the Holland Zealand Foundation, and you can tell the Holland Zealand Foundation specifically, say, this is where I want the benefit to go to, and I want so much income to come off of that per year, and I want that to be given to XYZ or to the scholarships for young people going off for college specializing in science. You can do a lot of those specialty items and gifting through, like, a foundation.
No, absolutely. I mean, so, you know, for the listener, you know, we greatly appreciate questions when people call in. And of course, it was for this listener in particular was for charitable regarding the church. And we talk, you know, last year we probably had more charitable deductions go to churches than any other organization. But we do, you know, we have a great relationship with the Holland Zealand Foundation. And so that's why Kerry's talking about. But there's a lot of ways. And, you know, somebody wants to set up a conversation regarding that. We have Mary Jo Borman, who is located in our office. And we have set some of those trusts up for both church and non-church affiliated donations. So, you know, we do talk about it. It's just sometimes it's very particular to an individual. And, you know, we talk about wealth transfer. It is, you know, then we talk about everybody. Sometimes when you're able to have a large enough trust or a large enough IRA and you're not passing everything down to your family, you know, we do encourage that to go to philanthropic. So last question, here we go. This is a question. We are going through a divorce and we have quite a bit of debt. Who is responsible for all of the debt? Well, both of you. It just depends on who signs. Sometimes a husband has a credit card. Sometimes a wife has a credit card. Well, you, as being the signature on that credit card, you're the owner. If you have a joint credit card, you both have the same credit card, you're both going to a, it's you both using the same credit card, going to a joint statement, you have a Macy's credit card, both use the same credit card, it's joint, one has a credit card, it's them. It's you know, a task to get through this debt. When you go through a divorce, you have to be careful of one person running up the joint credit card and not using their credit card in anticipation of a divorce.
Well, and, you know, when a divorce, you know, the law says basically everything's split 50-50, but in some cases, like you mentioned, Jack, if an individual, you know, husband, wife, if one has a credit card just in his name or her name, it's that person's responsibility.
Yeah, and it just seems like the last week I've had a couple different calls regarding prenups, prenuptial agreements where you're getting to your second marriage, third marriage, et cetera. You know, we always encourage people, no matter how much money you have, no matter how many assets you have, if you're going into a second divorce, somebody has a house, typically. Somebody has a house. Somebody has a car. And those assets, how do you divide those? Your kids, my kids, our kids, we always encourage you to have a prenuptial agreement, especially in a divorce situation that occurs after you've had that second or third mortgage. I mean, It's very important. So let's move on, Carrie. Hey, we have a lot to talk about. We have about 35 minutes on Guide to the Markets. This is a recap that we have, that we talk about. We get it from J.P. Morgan. They're a sponsor of ours. We do, you know, we really have a good relationship with them. They are a top-tier vendor, and they always give us great. It's like 60 pages. Actually, it's not 60 pages. It's, 68 pages. 68 pages of research that we can talk about. And one of the ones, of course, is, you know, you always take a look at what's the large picture dating all the way back to 1997. And, of course, you know, nobody really wants to talk about that far back. They want to talk about what's going on now. But if you go all the way back to 1997, 97 all the way to March 2000, the market ran up 106. 2000 down to 2002, down 49%. 2002 to 2007, went up 101%. 2007, October, down all the way down to the infamous date of March 9th of 2009, the low of the market, down 57%. Now we're on a run from March 9th of 2009 to March 31st, 2014. We're up 177%. Those are big numbers. And, you know, people keep on asking because, you know, it's you listen to the national news, and, of course, they want viewers. They want to talk about bad things. And they want to talk about traders. You know, Carrie, we talk about this a lot. We're not traders.
That's correct, yeah.
We help investors.
Well, and, you know, you're talking about those numbers, and we've had a great run in the market, and now people have kind of, like, I know you mentioned once in a while, I know I mentioned, we kind of forget, you know, when the market was down, and we need to remind our listeners, and, you know, we say this to our clients, we need to remember that the market is naturally going to swing up and down, and that's just normal. Always going up is not normal, and, you know, we've kind of gotten used to it always going up right now, and so we need to just, you know, keep things in perspective. Wouldn't you agree?
No, it's always got to be in perspective, and, you know, we always got to say, you know, I go back a lot and say, geez, I bought a brand new car in 1976, a Velari 4500. Well, now that same identical car is probably selling for $22,000, $20,000. Cars ramp in value, too expensive. You know, don't buy a new car.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but, I mean, prices go up. Things cost more. So, you know, we talk about, but is it good value comparatively to what? And we always talk about, I know it's boring for some people to listen to this, but you really got to understand price to earnings, price earnings ratio, the price you're paying for this, is it good value according to what they're earning? Now, if we go back to 2000, when people were crazy, 1999, people were buying stuff that didn't have any earnings. Do you remember those days, Carrie?
Oh, absolutely. You know,
we were in the business.
Yeah, and you think back to the dot-com bubble, you did think back to all those companies had price-to-earnings ratios that were out of sight, really, and were not realistic, and these companies were not even making money, some of them.
Nope. So it's you know, I'll just go through some of these. I mean, the price-earnings ratio for large cap value right now is 14.3. That's the current PE. The 20-year average for that is 13.9. So we're right at fair value for that. Now we look at other sectors. They've ran up a little bit. If you look at one of our favorite spots to be is mid cap. Well, if you look at mid cap value, that's a little bit. 16.4 is what where it is right now. The average is 14.1. So some of the value sectors have ran up. If we look at growth, large cap growth, and this is where we think value is right now. I mean, this is where we think is you can have a bargain right now. Large cap growth average P/E ratio 20 years 18.3. I'm sorry, what it is today 18.3. The average is 20.9. So we're still below the 20-year average. So there's still room to grow based on the average. If we take a look at small cap growth, which, you know, ran up quite a bit last year, The average right now is 21.3. The 20-year average is 21.4. So it's still fair value according to the average, even though over since 2009, small cap growth is up 274%. That's a big number.
That is a huge number.
That's a big number. Other things there, Kerry, that you want to go to while I continue to work through the slides?
Well, you know, I just want to kind of comment on, you know, what you talked about, Jack, is, you know, when you look at the average of the price-to-earnings ratios that the media, you mentioned, the media tells us certain bits and pieces of what's happening in the market. They say it's overvalued, it's overpriced, and we have to step back from that. Yes, there may be certain investments that are overvalued and overpriced, but when you look at the overall averages in large growth, large value, medium-sized companies, small companies, we're in line with the averages, and we are not overvalued. And that is so important to remember, that there is still a lot of good investments that are out there to be purchased by people. And like you said earlier, we are not stock pickers. We are investors, and we help manage people's assets and make sure that it meets their unique individual needs.
Here's another good one, Kerry. This is corporate cash. Way back in 2000, corporations had 14% in cash. Today, the average, we're talking S&P 500 companies, are on top 500 companies, they have a little bit north of 30% in cash. We also see just a correlation with that is mergers activity. So the number of companies combining their assets, lowering their cost, is way up right now. So we have people with cash. I mean, large companies have cash. 2000, they didn't have this much cash. So now they can withstand something. They can buy things, and they've accumulated this cash because they've hunkered down during some of those bad times of 08, 09, and have not expanded because our government sometimes doesn't paint a clear picture of what can we anticipate with regulations next year. What can we anticipate with taxes next year? So they've pulled back a little bit, but once this cash is put to work, you know, we're going to have a faster economy than we do now. We don't have a fast economy, but things have ran up fair value-wise. But if we're looking for an expansion, the cash is there to do the expansion. Or they're going to give it back in dividends. And if I look at the dividend payout ratio of current 500 companies, they're nowhere near giving the dividend they did back in 07, 08, 09. So that's why we think more growth is still coming. So that's a good thing. And then we also talk about, this is a very good slide we have here. It is called the annual return and the intra-year declines. So the average return per year, and what has the decline been? So if we look at year-to-date through the first 3 months, the market is up 1%, and we've seen it go down as far as 6%. So its average rate of return for the first 3 months, again, we're talking the S&P 500, is 1%. If we go back and take a look last year, it was down 6% was the max, and it finished up the S&P 30%. If we go back the previous year to 12, it was down 10% and finished up 13. If we go back to that flat year of 2011, it was flat, but we were down at one point during the year, down 19%. So you have to understand that even in positive years, if I go back to the biggest year that things were positive, it was probably in 1987. The market was down 34% at one time, and it finished up 2%. And, of course, 87, people remember that. That was a big bond year where the bond market helped in that crash. But those are some things that people need to put in perspective is a volatility during the year. Again, it comes in responsibility is typically on the Fed. The Fed comes out and says we're going to not go through some of this quantitative easing right now. We're going to taper back. We're going to raise rates, which they haven't. So some of those things that we go through, what's the perspective? It's not the companies that you're investing in causing this. Again, it's a market reaction to what the government has to say. So those are some good things to talk about, Kerry.
Yes, yeah, they are absolutely. It's just a good reminder of the normal swings in the market. I'm just kind of looking here through, perusing some things here, Jack, and I was going to go back to, just looking at the overall year-to-date. Year-to-date, we're still up in the large cap area, and we're down in the small cap area. And in mid, we're up, but except for mid growth, it's down slightly. But year-to-date's doing good year-over-year for the past 3 years. All sectors are still showing a positive return of north of 11%. So I think that's excellent.
That's really good. If we take a look at what the components of the GDP, we're always talking about GDP, and I looked at a big map of GDP yesterday. I didn't bring it today. Is GDP for the U.S., we're looking at a growth of about 3.2 this year. But if we look at GDP, what's it made up of? Consumption. That's personal consumption is 68.2. Government spending is 8.2. Investment minus housing investment. That means we're building buildings, building factories, is 13.1. Housing is only 3.1 right now. And net exports, we're still at net exports, negative 2.7. So that draws away from GDP. But you look at some of those larger countries, we're still growing above them. And so if you look at the average GDP, it's been about 3.1. That's the 50-year average. And guess what? That's what we expect it to grow. So, it's not as fast as some years, but that is the 50-year average. And we go back to some pretty fast-growing years. So what else you got, Kerry?
I'm looking at, the federal budget and where we spend our money. And, this is actually going back to one of the things on the, by the numbers, but, the U.S. government has a streak of 42 consecutive monthly deficits, through March of 2012, and that's an all-time record. But since then, seven of the subsequent 24 months have generated a surplus. So, the government is trying to get things straightened out, but again, the big expenditures are your, Social Security, your entitlement programs are where most of the spending is taking place.
Yep. Hey, Kerry, we're going to take a break right now. You're listening to WHTC Money Matters. We're live today. I'm live in the studio with Chris. Kerry's out on the road today. Going to watch the doubleheader of baseball. We're talking Guide to the Markets. We'll be right back. Good morning. This is WHTC. Jack Godfrey here live. Kerry Cooley calling in today. We're talking about Guide to the Markets. We're reviewing the first quarter. There's always interesting things to talk about, and here's one of those. It's called the Housing Affordability Index. So if we go back all the way to 1980, it looks like the average percent of people who could look at a house was maybe 40% average, percent of household income. And now it's down to 13%, but it's been rising. It was down at 10% was the low. The average was about 20%, but it's now at 13.1. It's come up from the low. So, houses are going rapidly today. You can see that around. We see a for sale sign one day and it's gone the next. So, housing, more people are buying houses today. The interest rates are at an all-time low. I think you still get a 30-year mortgage for somewhere under 4% today if you have the ability to get that rate. So that's pretty good. We take a look at unemployment. Unemployment peaked, somewhere around 11, 12%. That's the total. The average 50-year rate's about 6.1, and we're at 6.7 right now. Again, this is a federal civilian unemployment rate. Do we think that's the real rate? I don't. Any comments, Kerry? And I guess Kerry's not with us. He's probably not plugged in. So he's gone. Okay. So we're talking about unemployment. The average, I think the average is closer to probably 15 with people not being able to find work, they've given up. And, of course, if you're not searching for work, they don't have that statistic. If we look at during the hard times there, 07, it started in 07, we lost 8.8 million jobs. We recovered 8.7. But, of course, that doesn't consider all the people who look for work during that time frame. Up till, you know, even today, how many people are not employed because they can't find work? And every year we're graduating, people having more kids, people working longer, not giving up their jobs to some other people. So I think the unemployment is closer to 15%, not that 6.7 that the federal government. We're always talking about government spending. This is a great report that we get here. We're always talking about government spending. So when we talk about, let's just go through the percentages. So if we take a look at Medicare and Medicaid, they absorb 25%. This is a mandate. We cannot fund this. I mean, we cannot not fund it. It is mandatory. 25% of all the revenue we take in is Medicare and Medicaid. If we take a look at Social Security, of course, we must pay out Social Security. That is 49%. So 50% of all the money we take in is mandated. Defense, 17%. Non-defense discretionary, 17%. 34% goes to defense. Our interest rate is 7%. The other is what we're able to say in the budget that we can negotiate, spend, go less, go more, fix roads, give out to foreign governments, is 10%. That's all that we have of all of our money that we take in. We have discretionary spending on 10%. Where are we at with money coming in? So income, actually taxes for individuals, 39%, corporations, 10%, Social Security insurance, 29%, other, I don't know what other makes up, 7%. We're borrowing 15% every year. We're borrowing 15% every year to keep this society of the U.S. government going. So couldn't you imagine if you had to borrow 15% every year and continue to be able to have a life? It's just unbelievable of what we have. If we're going back to, you know, I always talk about the education levels. This is a statistic, and it's different every quarter. And we talk about the average, the high school graduate, what his average earnings would be over his lifetime. It's about $32,630. You jump up to the next one, the average annual earnings rate of the next degree, bachelor degree, the average earning over his lifetime is going to be about $60,159. You go to an advanced degree, what would that advanced degree, I don't know, certification, a doctor, that's now $89,000. Average compensation, $89,253. So, again, you do not need to go to college to be successful. It's just a longer road to be successful. Other topics, you know, other topics we always talk about, energy. Energy is one that we always like to review. And if we take a look at the United States today, major consumers, we consume 21% of the energy in the world. If we take a look at China, they're a lot bigger than us. They take only 11%, Japan, 5%, India, 4%, Saudi Arabia, 3%, Brazil, 3% of the world's need for energy. If we take a look at major producers, Saudi Arabia, 13%, United States, 12%, Russia, 12%, China, 5%, Canada, 4%, Iran, 4%. So we're inching up, only 1% away from that top category, which is Saudi Arabia. And I think that if we continue. So here's a natural, this is the U.S. natural gas production, which is continuing to go up, the production, which is pretty doggone good. But the thing you got to take a look at is what are we getting? The natural gas prices right now are $5.97. If we take a look at Japan, that's 18. If we take a look at Germany, it's 10.83. How are we able to sell some of that gas abroad and get to the world rate? Of course, we'd have to pay more if we're going to go to the world rate. We're going to have to pay more as well. Got about 10 more minutes here in the show. If you want to ask us anything, give us a call, 395-1450. Kerry Cooley is now gone for the day, or is he back on the line?
He has bowed out. I called him back, but he said he's got really spotty reception.
Okay,
so
okay, good. Yep,
it's
he's
all
bowed
you.
Out. That's fine. We can take it. If we want to take a look at where we are with fixed income, I mean, fixed income is always what we want to take a look at because how does that take a look at where you are? Looking at where can you generate income and not be in the market. If we take a look at the last 10 years, global high yield has returned 143%. Emerging market debt has returned 148%, which is, that's both interest return and appreciation. So high yield debt and emerging market debt has been the leaders. If we took it annually last year, emerging market debt was up 9.5, global high yield was up 9.3. Last was government treasuries government securities 4.1, government treasuries 4.2. If we take a look at the average over a 10-year period, the asset allocation for fixed income, if you're in a variety of fixed incomes, treasuries, munis, TIPS, etc., high yield, emerging market debt, over a 10-year period, you earn about 7%, which is, that's pretty doggone good if you were well allocated in each one of those. If we look at treasuries right now, treasuries as of March 31st, 2014, are about 1.16. That's the average treasury right now. So fixed income is always needs to be part of your portfolio. If you want to be in a growth and income bracket, that's always important to take a look at. You know, high yield, we personally in our office, we do a lot of high yield because we try to manage the interest rate. We try to manage the duration. We try to manage the risk. We also use some alternative incomes, which have been great at 6 and 7%. But high yield has held the value over the last year when many people doubted that high yield was going to hold its value, but it continues to hold its value. Fixed income globally is one that you need to always have some of your fixed income portfolio there. So part of that is because we see emerging market debt going up. I mean, of course, emerging market debt also takes on more risk because, one, you don't know if Greece, Italy, Russia is going to pay back their bonds that they borrowed. So if you're going to borrow, you know, there's some good global bonds out there. But Chris says we're going to take a break right now. We're going to take our last break of the day. We're at 10:51. We'll be back. More Guide to the Markets. Listen to WHTC. Jack Godfrey will be right back. We're back live listening to WHTC Money Matters. Jack Godfrey, we're talking about Guide to the Markets right now. We are reviewing the first quarter. Now we're down getting to the nitty-gritty of where's the best place to have your money so far this year. If we look at the asset classes, so let's take a look at this year, first quarter, best place to have your money is in real estate investment trusts. We've been telling that to people for a long time, up 8.5 first quarter. Second, commodities. You know, we're encouraging people to buy commodities starting at the end of the year's first quarter. It's up 7%. S&P up 1.8. So, you know, you always need to have some on the fringe. And when I say the fringe is allocate 3 to 5% on the fringe. That's commodities. That's REITs. That's some alternatives. And they right now they're paying you handsomely because other asset categories are flat or up 1. So, again, that's real estate investment trust up 8.5. We're also taking a look at commodities up 7%. If we take a look at the best place to be in 2013, that'd be the Russell 2000 small cap growth. So if we take a look at where we are cumulative for the last 10 years, European countries have been the best place over a 10-year period, up 197%. The Russell 2000 up, which is small cap growth, up 138. Real estate investment up 128. S&P 104%. We take a look at the bottom. So we take a look at a 10-year. The commodities are down 9%, not down, average 9% for 10 years. I'm happy with 9%. That's the total. with 5% of your money, because you always have to be at the highs and the lows. But if you look at 197% for the EFA, that is a big number. You take a look at the Russell 2000, that's a big number. If you take a look at the average has been 100% for 10 years. So you've averaged 10% for a 10-year period. That's a big number. You have to get past those years, though, of 7 and 8. If we take a look at truly alternative investments, the best place to be over a 10-year period has been private equity, the Warren Buffett-type private equity. It's hard to buy that. We have some mutual funds that just specialize in private equity. Look at the best place to be over a 10-year period earning 15% per year would be MLPs. So that would be private limited partnerships. Those have returned 15% per year for a 10-year period. If we go back to real estate, that's earned 8.5. The average global equity has earned 7.3. So those are some averages. So, you know, on those fringe areas, you need to make sure that you have some of those in your portfolio. Again, 3 to 5%. We call it the outliers, 3 to 5%. Gold has not been a good investment for a long time, so we do like commodities, but gold is only a small portion of that commodity sector. If you take a look at cash right now, cash is getting you nothing. Cash is not king today unless it's in your emergency account. We as an investment firm can always do better than cash, but we want you to have cash for emergency money. So cash is always important. It just depends on. Cash, you still got to pay taxes on when it's in your account, making that 0.25%. You're still paying tax on that. So let's talk about next week. Next week, we're going to talk about save for college. Do you save for yourself or do you save for college? Do you save for the kids? Do you pay for the kids' education? What should you do? How do you save for college? What is a great percentage? So next week, we're going to talk about both save for yourself or save for your kid. How do you determine what that's going to be? How much for each one of those? So that's next week. Hey, we're done with our show today. Thanks for listening. Carrie and I will both be live in the studio next week. You're listening to WHTC Money Matters. Call our office. You got any questions? 616-931-1223. Enjoy the weekend. Happy Easter.
You've been listening to WHTC Money Matters with your hosts, Jack Godfrey and Carrie Cooley from the Cooley Godfrey Investment Group of Zealand. The opinions voiced in this show are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult with your attorney, accountant, financial advisor, or tax advisor prior to investing. Securities are offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA, SIPC. Be sure to join us next Saturday at the same time for WHTC Money Matters on 1450 WHTC, Holland's hometown station.